God's Word. We're going to preach a lesson that I think is going to be encouraging to all of us. But before we begin, I want to start with this introduction. The Russian revolutionary, Vladimir Lenin, he espoused a philosophy that really said this: to trust is good, but control is much better. And it's amazing when you listen and study and observe history. Historians tell us that this revolutionary philosophy was indeed the undoing of the Soviet Union. And the reason that is because it created an atmosphere of secrecy and suspicion 24/7. Every time that people walked, every time that people talked, every time that people slept, they had always to look over their back. Who was spying on them? Each spy had a spy to spy on them, and the other spy had another spy. Everybody was spying on one another, and no one knew who spoke the truth from error. No one knew, and no one could distinguish between a friend and a foe. People only said what the state wanted them to say. The government was spending so much money, we learn from history, in order to have total control of the people. They were investing so much in order for them to have this iron grip on the minds, the hearts, the soul of the people. They wanted to give the semblance, at least, the impression that they were in total control, but yet they could not verify one truth about one person. Lies were used to hide the truth, the very truth that the Russian government did not want to hear. So everybody else created this huge environment for lies, because that's what allowed them to stay protected. And what happened, folks? This very lie became the cancer that destroyed life. Not only the life of the huge Soviet Union, but the very life of the people who live within that system. And the cancerous ideologies of Marxism and communism destroy, folks, this huge, huge system. Now, I don't believe most of us here, if not anybody here, really espouse this doctrine or this ideology that the revolutionary Russians believed in. That they want total control. That indeed, trust is good, but control is much better. But I think there is a tiny little bit of this impulse within us that says, even for us Christians, that you know what? Trust in God is good, but control over my own life is much better. But tonight, I'd like for us to look very briefly at the idea that indeed, trust in God is the only way that allows us to have full control over our lives. I want us to understand tonight, folks, and really talk about the idea that control is good, but trust is much better. We need to learn to surrender to God. Let us start this evening in Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 23. And actually, we'll look at verses 23 and 24. In a sense, we want to rebut this idea that trust is good, but control is better. Rather look at the idea that, well, control is good, but trust is much better. Surrendering to God is the way to live. Jeremiah tells us, folks, in Jeremiah chapter 10, and I'll be reading verses 23 and 24. He says this: I know, O Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man who walks to direct his steps. Correct me, Jeremiah says, O Lord, but with justice, not with your anger, or you will bring me to nothing. Now, the one question we want to ask this evening is simply this: why do we so often desperately try to have control of our own lives and resist to surrender to God? Why is it that even Christians, folks, trying to take care of their own lives, their own souls, their own minds, and their own hearts with God's peripheral help? Why is it so hard for us to say, like Jeremiah said here, I know, Lord, that a man's way is not in himself, nor is it in a man to walk to direct his steps? Well, I would venture to say, folks, that most of those radical revolutionaries in Russia were obsessed in micromanaging people, not because they were all tough, not because they had all control, but in reality because they were scared out of their minds. Fear, most of the time, folks, causes us to resist God. Fear, folks, when it's ingrained deep within us, forces us, or sometimes causes us, to take control of our own lives, our own destiny within our hands, rather than us just throwing our lives into God's hands. How many relationships are on the rocks? I'm not talking about people in the world. I'm talking about people right there in the church. Husband is taking his stand and wife is taking his stand. And then there come a times where they think they will need some kind of intervention. But guess what? Everybody's standing their ground. They want to be in full control of their own lives. No one wants to surrender and say, you know what? We need help. Nobody wants to be wrong. And yet we slowly see the disintegration of this relationship. But when we step into the church doors, guess what? All is fine and dandy. How many fathers are fighting with their daughters and sons over control? And no one wants to relent. No one wants to give in. No one wants to surrender because that's the better way. And as much as he tries to control this young person, curfew at 6 o'clock. You need to do your homework. No TV. You know, you got grounded for 2 months. You need to read your Bible. Let's say a prayer for an hour and all those things. By the time he's 17 or 16, he's out of home, never to be found again. Lost control in a desperate try to be in control. Folks, how many people have this paralyzing fear? That maybe if God comes home tonight, they would not be ready. But yet, it's so hard to admit that. Yet, it's so hard for us to accept that and let other people know that we are in doubt about our faith. And maybe with a little more teaching, maybe with a little more encouragement, we may get the strength. Many people resist to say, folks, like the guy said in Mark chapter 9 when Jesus confronted him. Remember in Mark chapter 9, turn there real quick. We have a man there, father, who's desperate for help. His son is suffering. And so he comes to Jesus and listen to what he asked in Mark chapter 9, very quickly here. Very interesting text, folks. Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 20. The text says, they brought the boy to him. When he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into a convulsion. And falling to the ground, he began rolling around and foaming at the mouth. And he asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. Jesus was very interested in this young man. And so he asked the father, how long has this young person been besieged by this terrible, terrible disease? But now notice what verse 21 says. It has often thrown him both in fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, in a sense, he had a 5 to 10% doubt in the ability of Jesus to heal this young boy. If you are able to do something, he asks, he says, take pity on us and help us. Listen to what Jesus' response is. You can? You mean you have lost total control over this kid and his health. You are helpless. But yet in your desperation for help, you are still trying to gain some kind of control over him and ask me if I can? He fell down on his knees and he says this, Lord, I believe, but please help my unbelief. Have you heard anybody walk down the aisle and come and say, I confess? I am a Christian for 20 years, but you know what? For some reason, the last year or so, I've been crippled by fear. I've been crippled by doubt. And please, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Or we just let everybody know what they're supposed to know about us. We are fine. We got this.
We're in total control.
What is it? And some people, folks, sadly, are struggling with their own inner demons. I don't know what it is. Prescription pills, for instance. They've been medicated for pain, and then all of a sudden, by accident, they fall in love with the medication. And they're so strictly just popping pills. But yet they're trying to figure themselves out of this problem by saying, you know what? Somehow I will figure it out. I don't need no AA. I don't need to call the preacher. I don't need to call the elders. I don't need no intervention from God. I'll get this. And they sit lower, deeper into trouble. How about young men addicted to pornography? It's their own little secret. Nobody knows about it. Maybe if I get a girlfriend, then I can get over it. And they try to date girlfriends and then go well. Maybe when I get married, I'll get over it. They get married, it gets worse. Maybe when we have kids, my attention, my focus will be on the kids, and it will just somehow go away. Destroys them, folks. Terribly. What about strong leaders in the congregation that are bogged down by anger, becoming prisoner of their own emotions? Wife can't say a thing that she's not wrong. The kids can't talk at the table before being slapped in the face. Somebody just missaid a word or missaid the announcement, and he's going to know about it. He's going to hear about it. He's just going to snap. But yet he doesn't want to surrender for help. It is amazing, folks, as we're going to see here tonight, that God has an amazing way to really restore us to full integrated human beings. He calls us to come to him because he's the way, he's the life, and indeed, he's the truth. It is only when we speak the truth about our own circumstances, no matter how weak we are, no matter how strong we are, no matter how much we're struggling, if we come to God in all humility and just say, I give up. I don't care about taking control of my life because I want you to control me. It is amazing to what height God takes you. Only if you allow him in. Let go and let God. In Psalm 118, listen to what the psalmist says here. In Psalm 118, in a sense, he talks about the appreciation for God to take control over his life. And I really like the words he uses here in Psalm 118. I start in verse 5. Psalm 118, I start in verse 5. Listen to what the psalmist says. From my distress, I called upon the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me in a large place. The Lord is for me and I will not fear. What can men do to me? He asked. The Lord is for me among those who help me. Therefore, I will look with satisfaction on those who hate me. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man. Indeed, he's saying here, control is good, but trust is much better. Surrender is much better. It is better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in princes. To trust, folks, allows you to take risks. In a sense, you will take risks into the unknown world. And I think that's why so many times we're so scared to give up control. But to trust, folks, takes you into a land that I call the grace land, the land that God himself has created. To surrender to God causes you to stop hoping and praying that you get the right break in life. It stops you when you trust from living with a gnawing fear of wishing nothing bad or nothing worse happens. Rather, it causes you to travel light, to live freely, and to enjoy God's wonderful grace into your life. Trust is created when we are focused on being real. We speak the truth about our circumstances. We accept our limitations. We acknowledge where we are in our lives. That paves the way to true freedom, folks, to true liberation. Trust helps us to fight the right fight. It helps us to fight for God. Now, one thing I want to say, and as I read a little bit of the history about the early revolutionary in Russia, it says that this huge environment, the atmosphere, was polluted with mistrust. Mistrust. And mistrust causes us to fight against our own selves. It causes us to fight against other people around us. And it causes us to fight against God. And a case in point that I want to examine this evening is the man we call King Saul. We're in 1 Samuel. Let's turn there, please. 1 Samuel, we are in chapter 8. In a sense, when we look at the life of Saul, he's a microcosm of the attitude, of the mentality of the people of his day. Now, it came about, folks, as we know the story very well, that the people say, well, we are frustrated. We want a king. They look at Samuel and say, you are old. Your sons are disobedient. They're rebellious. Now we look all around us and we see all these wonderful nations. They have all those nice, powerful, strong kings. And we want to have a king just like them. And so sadly, Samuel listens to their appeal, to their request. And in verse 6. 1 Samuel 8, it says, but the thing, this request for a king, was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord, and the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they have said to you. For they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Listen to verses 19 and 20. After Samuel had warned them about the consequences of requesting a king over God, listen to what they say. Verse 19. Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go before us and fight our battles. In a sense, folks, they wanted Samuel to tell them what they wanted to hear. In a sense, they wanted Samuel, by him presenting them a new king, that, man, nation of Israel, you are in total control. You've got this. And even if I have to lie to you to make you believe that, that's what we're going to do. Even though Samuel was so upset. Now, let's look at Saul, this man that was chosen to be the first king of the nation of Israel. It is very interesting, folks, the description that is given about him. There's nothing said about Saul as far as his heart, his courage, his abilities. Notice verse 2 in chapter 9 about the first description given about Saul, this king to be. He had a son, talking about Saul's dad, whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. The description is fully physical. And there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than any other persons. Now let's turn now to verse 21. After Samuel had sat down with Saul and invited him to eat this wonderful feast, in a sense, to kind of like slowly anoint him as this new chosen king. In verse 21, we learn that Saul replied after Samuel complimented him, am I not a Benjamite, verse 21, chapter 9, of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Why then do you speak to me in this way? In a sense, we tend to infer here that maybe he was really humble. Maybe he was timid. Maybe really he was not boisterous. He was not really a man of big courage, but really humble. Now, we want to continue on the same line here. It came about when Samuel was going to present Saul publicly, this new chosen king,
that Saul was nowhere to be found. Chapter 10, and I'll start in verse 22. Very telling here, folks. Chapter 10, verse 22. Saul was chosen by Lot. And now when it came to his name, everybody looked around and said, where is he? He's tall, handsome. We should naturally be able to see him. But then God helped them to identify where Saul was at. Verse 23 says, therefore they inquired further of the Lord, has the man come up yet? So the Lord said, behold, he's hiding himself by the luggage. Now the question that I ask is this, what did Saul know about himself that everybody else did not know? Did he, maybe, was he struggling with some sense of inferiority complex? That he was scared out of his mind to be a leader? Was he perhaps more of a follower than a leader? Was he struggling with some kinds of emotional, mental problem? But yet nobody knew about? I don't know. But what we're going to see, folks, we're going to see the unraveling of this king, Saul. The more Saul became prominent as a king, the more, folks, we're going to know a little bit more about him as a person. The more we're going to discover that he craved control to compensate for what he could not control. Listen, in 1 Samuel chapter 10, we are in verse 8. Now, Samuel comes to Saul and he says, you know what, Saul? I'm going to give you some instructions. Let's turn to 1 Samuel 10, verse 8. He says, I'm going to give you some instruction here. Just listen carefully to me. And I think it's pretty easy for you to follow. You shall go down before me in Gilgal. And behold, I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and sacrifice peace offerings. You shall wait 7 days until I come and to you and show you what you should do. I think that's pretty simple, folks. Wait for me at Gilgal. 7 days, I will come and offer sacrifices. Do you think most of us would have gotten this down? I think so. Now, we turn to chapter 13 of 1 Samuel. And the text tells us that the Philistines had aligned themselves for battle. And all of a sudden, all the Israelites, they look at the huge Philistine army. They started getting scared. And Saul is slowly asking the question, well, where is Samuel? Where is Samuel? He says 7 days, he's going to be here. So before this huge army just ran us over, he decided to go against the prophecy of the prophet. He decided to take total control of the situation. Listen carefully, folks, to what happens here. Starting in verse 9. Saul noticed that the people starting to get scared. And slowly people were fleeing from the scene. And it appears that the power and the forces of the Philistines were getting bigger and stronger every second that they paid attention to them. And somehow it shook the insecurity that indwell this king Saul. Verse 9 says, so Saul said, bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offerings. As to say to the Israel, I got this. I've got total control over this. I've got this. And we continue to read, folks, in verse 10. As soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, behold, Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. But Samuel said, what have you done? For Saul could not accept the fact that God accepted him for who he was. But he chose to believe a lie. He chose to believe that he was way stronger than he was. He chose to believe that he was more faithful than he thought he was. He chose to believe, folks, that he was more able than indeed he was. And now what we saw, the people were distancing themselves from him. And God was distancing himself from him. The craziness, if you will, of Saul's desire and obsession for control increases. In chapter 14, we learn as they are getting ready to fight against the Philistines, he came up with this foolish edict. He says, actually, I don't want none of my soldiers to eat anything at all until I win this war, as if it was all about him. He wanted everybody to understand that he was the man. All the attention was upon him. All the credit was supposed to be given to him. And what are we supposed to win if we don't eat? But his son Jonathan had no idea about this stupid edict. He saw some honey and he ate it. And then everybody, oh, you're going to get in trouble. Oh my God, what did you do? Because Saul has said, nobody's supposed to eat. What in the world? And he even dared challenge Jonathan and tell him that you need to be put to death because you have violated God's command. Now he was God. But it gets worse, folks. Let's read in chapter 15. It gets worse. His obsession for control, folks, was really a telling sign that deep inside he had lost total control over his own life. But yet he wanted people to believe what they wanted to believe. He wanted to give the impression that all was well, because that's what he's supposed to say. In chapter 15 of 1 Samuel, God tells him, all right, I want you to wipe all the Amalekites. Kill everything that comes in your way. The king, the ships, all the booty of war. Kill it all. Well, he goes to fight. And then listen to verse 3. Listen to God's command first. Now go and strike the Amalek and utterly destroy them. But then in verse 9 it says, but Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatling, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly. He's just taking that upon himself. I'm going to despise God's command. I'm not going to surrender to him. I'm not going to trust God and know that he knows what's best. I've got this. And then Samuel comes. When Samuel comes, Saul is the first person to run to him. Hey, Samuel, praise God. For we have accomplished his command. Listen to what he says in verse 12. Samuel rose up early in the morning to meet Saul, and he was told Samuel, saying, Saul came to Carmel. Behold, he has set up a monument for himself. Then turned and proceeded down to Gilgal. Samuel came to Saul and said, Saul, what is it that I hear? The sheep in my ear, the bleating, the lowing of the oxen. What is it that I hear? But Saul says, verse 15, they have brought them from the Amalekite, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God. But the rest we utterly destroyed. It's not really my fault. I just told them and did what they wanted to do. And God came down hard through Samuel. Samuel said in verse 17, is it not true that though you were little, though you were insignificant, though you were, struggling with whatever insecurities, though you had no control of your life, is it not true that God gave you the strength? Is it not true that God enabled us to conquer all kinds of mountains and all kinds of trials and difficulties if only we surrender to him and trust? Samuel was telling Saul that, you know what, control is good, but trust is much better. In verse 22, he says, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to trust is much better than to try and have a sense of control over everything, even your own life. But he still did not learn. He still failed to learn, folks. Notice, chapter 16. We are simply looking a case in point about the struggle that we all have to give in to God because we're obsessed about control. But that control really is symptomatic of our fears. In chapter 16, folks, I start in verse 14. We see the unraveling and unraveling of Saul. He's been separated from his own self now. He's tormented. Now, the text says that Saul, every time that God will flee from him, the presence of God, the righteousness of God will go away from him, that he'll be terrorized by this spirit. And now he requested for somebody to come and play the music to soothe him. And that one man was David, the complete opposite of Saul. So this is what we find in chapter 16. And now in chapter 17, we have a big, big challenge. And if anybody craves control, you would think that Saul would step up and say, well, I've got this. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, we learn that this huge hero of the Philistine, his name is Goliath, he comes and starts taunting the Israelites. And when I'm reading this text, I will assume, the first time I will read this, that way, King Saul is going to come up, he's going to wear his armor, he's going to come with his sword, and he's going to tell everybody else, you cower on the bricks over there, on the wall over there, but I'm going to take care of this big giant. Because indeed, he's not big. But guess what he does? He's scared out of his mind. Everybody's trembling. And you know what fear does, folks? If it causes us to just blow things out of proportion. It forces us, in a sense, to make huge mountains out of small molehills. Fear has a way for us to just exaggerate the reality of things in life and circumstances. But that's what they said. So David comes along, and he's just asking, what's going on? What's the problem? Listen to the Israelites. Verse 24. When all the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him and were greatly afraid. Now, verse 26, then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, what will be done for the man who kills these Philistines and takes away the reproach from Israel? You have now this little boy who comes among these huge military personnel. He hears almost their knees just hitting one another. And he says, what is wrong? What in the world are you guys afraid of? Oh, you have not seen Goliath. You have not seen this huge giant. You have not heard about him. Actually, you better go way over there because you might get hurt. And David stood and he says, you know what? I see nothing but an idiot standing right there, and he's taunting my God. What giant do I see? Why are you guys scared? And David continues to show his power by simply saying this in verse 32. Let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with these Philistines. And this is why this is going to happen, David says. Verse 36. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and these uncircumcised Philistines will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God, my God that I surrender to, my God that I trust in, my God that I don't care to take any control away from him. He empowers me. He empowers all of us. Only if we're willing to let go of our fears, let go of our desire and obsession to be in control by surrendering to him. I see just a little bug, little insect. Just one squat, he's gone, David says. That's exactly what happened. I didn't need no sword. I don't need no armory. One blow, he was gone, dead. Now, as we come to the conclusion of this story, folks, at least for tonight here, this is what happens now. Huge celebration takes over Israelites. Everybody's jubilant. And guess who's going to take all the credit? The man who loves to be the center of attention. The man who loves to give the impression that he is in control, that he's really the reason why we're celebrating. King Saul, chapter 18. Now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. Verse 5. So David went out wherever Saul sent him and prospered, and Saul set him over all the men of war, and it was pleasing in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. Now, I want to ask you one question. Why do you think that Saul took David and gave him this high position of prominence in his courtyard? Is it because of David's merit or of how David makes Saul look? It was all for him. He surrounded himself by valiant men, able men, so that he will look good. He was trying to micromanage the lives of all people in this nation just to give the semblance that he is the king, but the king who had total power over everybody, even when deep inside he was being disintegrated to pieces. And folks, we conclude with this one thought. Listen to this. The celebration is going on. People are dancing and singing. Now the true colors of this powerful king is going to be exposed. The lie that he's been presenting all along is going to be exposed. That indeed Saul is out of control, because he's not learned to surrender to God. Verses 6 and following. Listen very carefully. It happened as they were coming, when David returned from killing the Philistines, that the woman came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, with musical instruments. The woman sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. That small three-letter word unraveled the king. It exposed a big lie he's been trying to perpetrate all that time. Just that word 10 was enough. Then Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. And the story goes on that he tried throughout his life to the day he died to kill David. First, you know what fear does? It breeds suspicions. It foments a sense of mistrust. It causes us to imagine things that are not there. He makes us blow things, small little things, out of proportion. The insignificant things become very significant when we are bowed down with fear. Fear, folks, make us become prisoners of our own lives. He makes us prisoners of our own past, our failures, our inabilities in whatever ways. God says, please, let's surrender to Him. Give Him the control. Give Him the power. And He will take us to this land He calls Grace Land. He will make us climb mountains that we never thought possible. He will give us the strength to conquer all kinds of demons. Put them to rest. That's what God does. I want you to pick up your song books real quick. Most of you may have experienced this, especially for your parents. There are times when kids, I don't know, 1 year old, 15 months, they come to a point where one of these days, they're just going to resist everything that you say. They are asleep, fighting it. Not ready to go to bed yet. They start crying. Well, you give them a candy. Well, they don't want candy. They want the toy. You give them the toy. They don't want the toy. They want the book. You give them the book. They don't want the book. They don't know what they want. But one thing they know is that they're not going to give up yet. They want to hang on to that little bit of control that they think they have. But you know what they miss out on? It's not cuddly, warm arms of the mom or dad. You know what they miss out on when they do that? A good night's sleep. But many times we find ourselves, folks, resisting God. Everything that we have. He knows everything about our lives. Why sometimes do we need to portray that all is well? That we're in total control. That we've got this. But yet we're just unraveling deep inside. Losing control. And everybody becomes a threat to us. Everybody misspeaks to us. Everybody who shows some kind of interest becomes the enemy. Surrender. Give in to God. Let go of your fears. If you have to come down here, I don't care if you've been an elder, and say, yes, I'm struggling, it will be the day that you become strong. Are you not a Christian yet? What are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? Jesus has His hands extended. He said, come. I will make that burden you're carrying very light. I will open the door of incredible possibilities. Come. Eat of my bread. Drink of my blood. Eat of my word. Become an integrated individual when you surrender to God. Whatever your need is, folks, please come as we stand and sing.